Are you ready? It's time for On the Double with the Double S Express. Great sports talk and big-time guests with Sean Wally and Sean Boyd on the Double with the Double S Express.
Am I wrong for thinking of the box from where I stay? Am I wrong for saying that I choose another way?
Good evening one more time, everybody. Sean Wally with Sean Boyd for On the Double. Hopefully everybody has survived Thanksgiving and lots of football.
Well, yes, man, I've survived Thanksgiving, probably put maybe a couple of pounds on, but man, the weather is changing here in Northern California. Yours truly outside, out and about with some college sports. I think I'm a little under the weather, so bear with me, Sean Wally. But man, I think we're going to make it through the show.
Well, technically, I'm thinking maybe you evened out those pounds you might have put on Turkey Day for utility, not one, but 2 days for the Pac-12 network.
Well, yeah, man, that's what I was mentioning. And, you know, 20,000 steps I think I took that day, which is not bad, moving around and up and down stairs and on the field and all over the place. So yeah, I knocked off the pounds, but yes, by doing that, in the pouring down rain that was coming down sideways at Stanford Stadium, I got a little bit of a cold.
So who was Stanford playing, and what did you think of your first Pac-12 Networks experience?
Well, I mean, actually, it was my second one. But, Stanford was playing Rice. So Rice came in from Texas. And, you know, this was one of those games, I believe, that, you know, they just put on the schedule at the end of the year. Stanford has already qualified for a bowl. So, you know, this is winter break for the students. So half the band was there. Less than half the crowd was there. And, you know, Rice came in and they got pummeled. And Stanford gave them a mighty blow, you know, in that last game of the season.
Nice to see rain falling in California, even though it might have got the better of you.
Yeah, so, you know, they're saying this year that there's going to be enough precipitation that we can lift the drought warning, if you can believe it or not. We've been in a drought for about 4 years. And so that means that this winter should be a great winter. Of course, living an hour and a half away from some of the beautifulest mountainous region in Lake Tahoe and, of course, the Reno area as well. I think that we'll be frequenting that and enjoying the snow.
Should be an interesting winter ahead for sure. Football, as you started to mention, college football winding down, of course, on Friday. The Apple Cup, the 109th Apple Cup in Pullman. And, man, did the Cougars even show up?
Yeah, man, it's, you know, this was one of the things that, you know, I believe Cougar fans, you know, believe this as well. You know, this has been a great season for Washington State Cougars, for the fans and for their likings. I mean, this isn't one of the teams back in the 90s or the Ryan Leaf teams. This is a team that I believe overachieved all year. Their schedule favored them mightily as far as some of the teams that they were facing as they were on the decline. We relished in it as far as them moving forward and chalking up the wins, but they're not Washington, and they're nowhere near what the Huskies were. And, you know, all Washington had to do was go out there and play their game, and they did just that, man, and the Huskies pounded on the Cougars in the Palouse.
The Huskies showed that they definitely are the better team.
Well, you know, here's the thing that they have to worry about now. You know, even with an awesome game that was played on Saturday, which I would probably say is one of the better games, probably one of the better collegiate games that we have ever witnessed in Michigan and Ohio State. Of course, there has to be controversy down the stretch. But with that being said, what a great contest. Number two against number three. And here's the part that the Huskies have to hope and wait for tomorrow, is that one of those two, meaning the Michigan Wolverines who lost, hopefully they will fall a spot. Now, you would think that, you know, common knowledge says, well, hey, if they lost, they dropped. No, that's not the case in this playoff situation. So the Huskies have to wait. They have to see if they move up a notch to get into that top four to be in the playoffs. They have to go and take care of business this upcoming Friday against Colorado. And, you know, here's the bad part about Washington, Sean, is their situation as far as them wanting to make the playoff. They're going to probably have to blow out the Colorado Buffaloes in order to get a consideration to be in the playoff.
Got a lot of time this hour to talk more football, but right now let's go out to the HolySmokeNuts.com phone lines and welcome in Jeff Baker, the sports enterprise and investigative reporter for the Seattle Times. Jeff, thanks for your time tonight.
Hey, glad to be on. I'm glad you're able to get that whole title out there without running out of breath. That's pretty good. It's a pretty big accomplishment.
It's definitely a long one, but hey, I'm here for you.
I drew it up myself, now, believe it or not.
Now he has to say it three times fast.
Yeah, you can try. I can only do. I only do. I get to do it about five times fast sometimes when I'm in the shower. That's what I do. I sing my job title out there. It helps pass the time.
Oh man. So Jeff, man, there's so much to talk about in the Pacific Northwest. Where do we start? Let's start with the Seattle Seahawks, man. A tough contest, a big game down in Tampa Bay. It was a game that I felt like, you know, Seattle should go down there and take care of business. But, you know, something else happened. And, you know, from your observation, you know, what did you see that were the big glaring problems in that game?
Well, I think, first of all, a road game in the NFL is always a road game in the NFL. There's no such thing as an easy game on the road. At any level of football, even if you're talking college or high school, I mean, it's tough, and especially in the pros. You know, I think that Tampa Bay team is a little bit better than its record perhaps indicates. And you know, I think what we learned most from that game is that the Seahawks offensive line still hasn't resolved all of its issues. You know, they're playing more consistently than they did last year at times, and they haven't really had a stinker game like this in quite a long time, but they were just getting overmatched yesterday. I mean, that was clear to see. There was blocking assignments being missed on a lot of the plays, resulting in key sacks at key moments, and they never were able to get really, I mean, they fell behind too early. You fall behind by two touchdowns that early, you're playing catch-up the whole way. You're not going to have time to establish your run game and do all the kinds of things you probably wanted to do going into that game. And you know, we saw a bit of that last year in the playoff loss the playoff loss to Carolina, where, you know, the Seahawks were down so far so fast that they really never recovered. They recovered a bit in the second half, but it was already too little too late. And I think there was a bit of that going on yesterday. They were kind of off guard, caught reeling, and then Tampa made the plays they had to make at the key moments on defense. I thought the Seahawks did a really good job staying in the game. I was telling my wife, I was watching the game, I thought it should have been about, you know, 28-5 at halftime, maybe 35-5. It was that kind of game. But the defense was keeping them in it. Some Tampa Bay blunders kept them in the game. I really don't think it was that close a game. But it's a testament to Seattle's defense. I think that they were able to stay in it and give themselves a shot to win right up until the last few minutes of the game, because that's really not a game the Seahawks deserve to win. They got outplayed. They got outplayed, outclassed. They got to regroup and go back and find another way. They're still in first place, and you know, that's key, because you win the division, you get the home playoff game. Anything can happen after that. As far as winning the conference goes, you know, that took a blow yesterday. There's no doubt about it.
And of course, the obstacles of the NFL. What I mean by that is the scheduling. And it was grueling for these past three games. And, of course, coming home to play against the Panthers, how it started, they were at the Patriots, winning there, a tough game. Then coming home to play the Eagles, where they won at home, and then going to Tampa Bay. That is a lot of mileage for any team, whether you're an elite team or not. And I do think that Seattle boded well going down to Tampa Bay, all things considered, with the amount of mileage that they put on.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can take some positives. Look, I'm not going to be one of those guys that blows sunshine at you when there is none. I mean, I don't think there was very much sunshine to be found yesterday. I mean, like I said, I think the defense played well enough to keep them in the game. But that said, they had no business winning that game. You know, had Tampa Bay lost that game, you know, I think you'd have to do some serious soul searching on that team. It kind of reminded me of the Miami game to lead off this season when really the Dolphins outplayed the Seahawks the entire contest and yet somehow found a way to lose it at the end. And you know, that it would have been that kind of win had the Seahawks pulled it off. They just had a, you know, it was a bit of a stinker of a game. You can't overanalyze it. You don't want to overdissect it. The thing I would analyze specifically is some of the blocking assignments along that offensive line, because it looked like there were some missed assignments at times. Those guys were just getting around the linemen way too quickly for the professional level. It didn't look like the kind of game the Seahawks offensive line has turned in quite a while. You mentioned the New England game. I mean, that was a great game for the Seahawks linemen. And they have been picking up their play noticeably from last year when they had all kinds of problems. But this game I saw, I mean, it was no contest. They were just getting blown off the line, kind of like what we saw, I think it was last year when they lost to the Rams at CenturyLink. The Rams were just dominated the Seahawks front in that game. But I mean, you're talking about the Rams, who have the best, you know, best D-line in football, arguably. You know, not so much with the Bucks, and so for me that raised the big red flags, because that's not, you're not talking about a Rams type of defense, defensive front, you know, your front four. And they were beating the Seahawks. They were getting sacks when they were just rushing four linemen, you know, and they were dropping guys back into coverage. That can happen. You can't dominate an offensive line like that, and that's where I would take a serious look at what happened yesterday. But I'm not the coach. You know, I think their coach knows what he's doing. He's earned the benefit of the doubt, and they're a 7-3-1 team, leading the division by three games. I think they got to regroup. If it happens again next week, you know, then you start pushing the panic button a little. I don't know that that's going to happen two games in a row, but we'll see.
Jeff, not many people that don't know, right now they wouldn't know that you've spent most of your professional career covering baseball. With all of your football knowledge you're dropping, but the team you used to be the beat writer for, the Seattle Mariners, made a trade on Wednesday that was announced with Arizona. Your thoughts on that?
Well, my first thought was that there was obviously something going on with Taijuan Walker that, you know, isn't necessarily visible to the naked eye. And I've heard the rumblings like everybody else. I have not covered the team on a daily basis the way, you know, I used to do it, obviously. Back then, when I met Taijuan Walker, I was telling somebody this last night, I mean, he seemed like the most gracious, personable young man I've ever met. I spent some time with him and his mother, who was battling cancer at the time, and, you know, I believe she's in remission now. So I got to know them a little bit off the field as well, and I've had some dealings with him off the field, and he was always he was raised very well, very humble, very courteous. But I mean, some of the things I've been hearing about him since I left the beat in 2013, hearing things like, you know, he's stubborn, he's got to get it right in his head, he's resistant to coaching. I've heard all those kinds of rumblings, as have a lot of people that have been around the team. I don't know whether or not that's accurate or not. Only the people who are inside the Mariners organization could really, you know, speak to that. But I think that it was just a situation where they ran out of patience with Taijuan Walker. I think they thought, you know, this guy might mature into the kind of pitcher that wins a Cy Young Award, but it's probably not going to be here in Seattle. I liked the trade on paper. Now, I'm going to put the caveat on that. I've liked a lot of trades the Mariners have done on paper over the years, and they never seem to pan out quite the way the paper makes it look. So, you know, I'm very hesitant to give it a gold star, because I know how much stuff has backfired in the past. But look, you know, you've added an everyday shortstop. You've added an everyday leadoff man. They've been missing a leadoff man, a true leadoff man, since Ichiro left in 2012. Dustin Ackley was supposed to be the next guy, and he never panned out. Norie Aoki didn't pan out last year as the leadoff guy. It wasn't a very good acquisition. And so now you're adding your full-time shortstop, full-time leadoff man, and theoretically, he should be the answer to a lot of your problems on that offense. Not all of the problems, but quite a few of those problems on offense and on defense as well. I mean, Ketel Marte, I always liked his hustle. I always liked his approach at the plate. But, you know, over a full season, I liked him better 2 years ago when he first came up than what I saw last season over a full season from him. I thought that he kind of lacked some stuff. He didn't really... He seemed, people have called him a 4A player, and I think that's a very good description of it, because there was just something missing with him all the time, I think. And I looked at it and I said, is that a championship shortstop, a shortstop on a championship team? Does he make them better up the middle? And the answer to that is no. You have to be good up the middle if you're going to be a championship squad. It's been like that in baseball forever, and I just don't think he was the piece. Now, you know, will Segura be that piece? You know, quite possibly he will be. So we'll see. That's one piece of the puzzle. I still think they need to address the starting rotation a lot more than they have. I fully expect that they will address the starting rotation because right now they don't have a staff ace. Felix Hernandez is not the ace he used to be. Hisashi Iwakuma probably has his best years behind him. And, you know, you just traded Taiwan Walker, who was one of your big three that was initially supposed to carry you to a title. So you've got James Paxton left now from that group of three. But you really need, I think you need another one, probably two more established pitchers to come into that rotation. And really, you need Felix Hernandez to take his game up a notch from where it's been the last couple of years because it's not there.
Jeff, this trade with the Diamondbacks, do you think it's another way for GM Jerry DePoto to put his thumbprint on this team since Walker and Marte were not his guys?
Yeah, I mean, there's always part of that in baseball. Look, we don't know what this team is going to do financially yet this year, and that's, you know, I get tired of talking about it, believe me. I've been talking about it for a decade since I came to Seattle. But the Mariners have always kept a payroll that's in the mid-tier of baseball teams and not in the top tier of baseball teams. And, you know, it's been my belief for a while that they got to get their payroll into that top tier because, let's face it, last year they missed by a game or two, and really they missed because a lot of the guys they had in secondary roles probably were guys that they cut corners with. You know, and again, I'm talking about a guy like Aoki. You know, I mean, that was a very important addition, it turned out, because he saw a lot of time out there. And there were a lot of poorly played balls out in the outfield that I saw last season, and he wasn't the leadoff hitter they expected. But, you know, there's some guys they took chances on, little short-term additions. They tried to maybe cut some financial corners here or there, and it didn't work out. And it ended up costing the team. When Felix Hernandez went down, you know, that starting rotation got badly exposed for just how thin it was really behind its top one or two guys. And, you know, and that's why I say they've got to go out and improve that rotation and improve it with some quality pieces. And unfortunately, quality costs money. Look, everybody always says you don't have to spend to win a title, and it's true. You don't have to spend the most money to win a title. But if you're not developing players, if you're not developing frontline prospects every year and bringing them up to the major leagues, you're going to have to outspend your opponents in order to make up for that. And you look back at what the Mariners did for 7 years under Jack Cerensick, they really only produced one quality all-star player, and that's Kyle Seager. You know, they signed Iwakuma as a free agent, but development-wise, Seager's about the only one. And if that's going to be your only guy to show for from a seven-year rebuilding plan, you better be outspending your opponents in the division and in the rest of the league, or else you're just not going to make the playoffs. That's the way it goes. So, look, I agree the Oakland A's can get to the playoffs, and they've shown it with a $100 million payroll or whatever. The Mariners can't. The Mariners don't develop players as well as the Oakland A's. So when you're not developing them, you either got to take the next 5 or 10 years off and tell your fans, see us next decade, or you got to spend more money and try to win. And I think they got to spend more money this year to try to get that payroll up to a level where it's in the top tier of baseball, the top 10, and then take a run at it. Jerry DePoto has to make these trades right now because he doesn't know. We're not really sure how much money he has left to play with. And right now he probably just did himself a big favor by getting some of these players that he did without spending a whole lot more money to get them than he, you know, by going out and signing free agents. Does that make sense? I hope so, because I'm kind of talking myself out of breath here.
Yes, it does. Jeff Baker joining us here on the Double.
I got to get out more. I got to get out more and socialize. I got to talk with people more.
Yeah, we're off and running here on the Double, but man, Jeff, let's take a quick break and a deep breath here. How was your Thanksgiving, man?
I'll tell you what, it was great. We, my wife and I are moving into a new house. We're actually remodeling a house that we bought, and so we're in our old house right now. We've been remodeling this other house for, it seems like forever. We bought it 6 months ago. We got about another 4 months to go before we can move into it. And so it was nice just to take a break at our current house. And, you know, we invited some people over, had some friends over, nice quiet time with ourselves. And it was great just taking a break from all the construction hassle and stuff. I'll tell you what, that construction stuff can stress you out way more than the Seattle Mariners ever stressed me out over a decade of covering them. And you know, I'll tell you, it was nice. It was nice to spend some time. And it was great sitting and watching football on the, don't tell anybody this. I'm actually a Pittsburgh Steelers fan. So, you know, I was naturally going to like that last game because Steelers were playing. But then the previous game between Dallas and Washington, oh, that just made it. And actually, the first game, usually the Lions make me wish Thanksgiving would be over already because the Lions always they always put them on, and every year they kind of stink. But this year they actually they played it. It was a good defensive struggle for most of the game. It was a thrilling end. I was very happy with the football games that were on. So it was a really good Thanksgiving for me.
Yeah, I would say that there were some great games as well. Of course, you're mentioning Detroit having a good outing, and you know, Dallas. It goes without saying that was an excellent football game. I would have liked for the other team to win just to kind of bring a little parity to the league, but it is what it is. The Cowboys are doing their thing.
I'll tell you what. I have a theory. I think the league really needs the Dallas Cowboys. This league really needs Dallas. They need that team that everybody loves to hate. They need that team to be back with swagger again. You know, it's been a long time since we've seen the Cowboys put a team on the field that's really this good. And with a young quarterback doing what he's doing, I love watching Dak Prescott. I love watching the decisions that he makes. I don't see him make the dumb decisions that you see so many young quarterbacks make. He just seems like he's a second or third year guy already. It's hard to believe. It's just his rookie season. America needs that back again. You know, and I grew up loving to hate the Cowboys, and I'm sure a lot of people in this city do, just like they hate my team, the Steelers. But I think it's good. I think dynasties are good for sport. I don't like this whole parity thing. I don't want to see a team winning it 5 years in a row. But I think you need the good teams out there. You need the Darth Vaders out there for everybody to shoot at. Everybody loves to hate the New England Patriots. I think it's great for sport when you have that kind of stuff. And I think the Cowboys coming back is going to be great for football.
Now, Jeff, as you mentioned that, of course, there's that team, another team in the AFC outside of the Patriots that are returning themselves to a little bit of folklore, and that is the Oakland Raiders. Of course, they're another team that people love to hate, but I do believe that it's good for football that they're winning again. So you're talking about Dallas, Pittsburgh, the Raiders. What do you think about those Oakland Raiders in Northern California?
No, I mean, that's a great point. I think football has missed the Raiders being good ever since they went to the Super Bowl. What was it now, like 12 years ago? Something like that.
Yeah, 2002.
It's 14 years ago. And you know, they've really been awful ever since then when you look at it. I think that's certainly important. I don't think they're back to being the dominant team that they were. I know that their record's very good right now. I think they've been in a lot of close games. Feels like every game they've been in has come down to the last minute. But I'll tell you, they got a tough schedule coming up. So they've done themselves a favor by piling up the wins early here, because I think their record's going to level out a bit in the next few weeks ahead. They got some big rivalry games coming up, and they got some big road games coming up, and it's not going to be easy. Kind of like what you just mentioned with the Seahawks and all that travel. They're going to be a beat up team over the next few weeks, and so I think some of these wins that you're seeing them pull out in the last minute are going to probably end up going the other way on the Raiders. But, I grew up loving the Raiders, too. I was a Steeler fan first. Raiders were always my second favorite team, especially in the 70s and then in the early 80s when they won the Super Bowl by beating the Eagles. I just love their attitude. I read Jack Tatum's autobiography back when I was a kid. They call me Assassin, and you know, I just loved everything about them. I got to meet Howie Long at a football camp way back in the day. I got to meet Matt Millen back in the day when he was playing for the Raiders before he went to the 49ers. And, you know, I that was my second favorite team. I just liked what they were about. I liked that they were the anti-establishment.
Well, you know, Jeff, I knew there was a reason that I liked you, man. And yeah, now I know why. Having the Oakland Raiders as one of your favorite teams and Los Angeles Raiders, I know that was a tough time for all of us. But
yeah, we don't really count the Los Angeles part of it in the whole equation.
But you're right. I mean, the Raiders have a tough schedule. They have a lot of games on the road down the stretch. They have one this weekend against the Bills. And the tough games are the divisional games. They're at the Chiefs. They're at the Broncos on New Year's Day. Those are going to be tough games that I believe will decide who's going to win that AFC West and possibly maybe a home game or a home field advantage.
Well, yeah, especially the Chiefs. I mean, it's hard to figure the Chiefs out. Ever since Andy Reid took over the Chiefs, and believe me, my wife's from Philadelphia, and her whole family's from Philadelphia. They're all Eagles fans. And, you know, Andy Reid, he's a sore topic of conversation, because when you would watch the Eagles back in the day when they were, you know, going to the Super Bowl or almost making it every year and then getting stopped 4th-and-1 on the goal line every single year and not going to the Super Bowl, that you know, Andy Reid became a four-letter word at one point, and then he moves on to the Chiefs. And, you know, I can't make heads or tails out of which way the Chiefs are going every single year, because some years they just look great and they look like they're going to win the Super Bowl, and then they fall off a cliff and you know, they can't do anything right. I think it, you know, it starts with the quarterback perhaps, but you know, it seems like every year though they're kind of one of those teams that you don't want to necessarily play, especially at Arrowhead. I remember the Seahawks going in there a couple of years ago when it was freezing cold, and they ended up losing that game. And the Chiefs are the kind of team that just make it tough on you. You know, you know, they know how to run the ball. They usually know how to run the ball very well. And when it does start to get cold at Arrowhead, I mean that has a huge impact on things. And you know, and their defense is usually good enough to keep them close. And you know, those are hallmarks of Andy Reid teams. And so I think, I think that's going to be a tough game, definitely for the Raiders. And you know, I think the key for the Raiders is to stay as healthy as they can over the next few weeks, because it's going to, you know, those games are going to be very physical, especially in Denver as well, against that defense. And you know, you got to come out of it reasonably healthy if you're going to have a chance to go anywhere in the playoffs.
Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times joining us. And Jeff, we could keep you all night, but I don't want to do that to you. But just a quick synopsis.
Hey, I got my own podcast I'm trying to put together here. Before you guys call, I've got my own podcast. It's called The Heart Count with Jeff Baker. Imagine that. We were going to call it something else, but we figured we'd use my name. And so I sit here, that's what I do all day Monday now. I sit here putting my podcast together, and it's not a live thing like you guys do. I have to sit here and record little bits and snippets of it, but it comes together eventually. So I just thought I'd get a free plug in there with you guys before. It's on every Wednesday, so you can get it on iTunes, you can get it on RSS or whatever they call that, and you know, all that other stuff. So get it on the Seattle Times website too if you want. If you wanted to go old school, you can do it that way. So
that's right, Jeff. We
go
had
ahead.
That
ask me what you're gonna ask me what you're gonna count? Ask me. I keep interrupting you. So go on.
Hard Count with Jeff Baker, available at SeattleTimes.com.
We were gonna call it Hard Count with Ryan Divish, but it didn't have the same feel to it, you know. So we figured we would use my name. Anyway, I'll stop trying to be funny. Go ahead, ask me a question.
All right, Seattle Arena, where do you think we end up, and why is it going to take 7, 8, 9 more months for the city to do anything?
Well, I think the city has an asset right now in Key Arena that is an existing asset. The city owns it. There is no debt to it. Debt's been paid off. The city's making money on the arena right now. Now, if they build a new arena in SoTo, as Chris Hansen has proposed to do, then automatically Key Arena is going to overnight become a money-losing venue, because nobody's going to want to bring your concerts, this and that, and the other, to Key Arena when they're all going to the SoTo Arena. And so the city right now sees it as its civic responsibility, and I agree with that, to explore all options with this arena before you go ahead and approve another arena that's going to have an impact on something that the public already owns. Like, the public's not going to benefit necessarily from Chris Hansen's arena. Chris Hansen is going to benefit from it. It's an all-private arena, but he's also owning all the land and all the development around it. He's going to make a lot of money on this thing. Now, the public isn't necessarily going to make money on it because they've got no investment. But the public does own Key Arena. And so when you're an elected government, it's your responsibility to explore that. And so that's what they're doing right now. They're looking at the AECOM report, which is another public investment the city made. They paid all that money to the AECOM group to go and explore the future of Key Arena. And they said, hey, you actually can renovate this for NBA and NHL, despite what everybody thought for the last 20 years. There are ways to do it now, more modern ways than what we had even 2 or 3 years ago, or 5 years ago necessarily. They said the whole dimensions of arenas around the NBA and NHL are changing. They're starting to go smaller in a lot of cases. And what we thought was going to be the NBA, NHL standard 5, 10 years ago is no longer the case. And so right now what they're doing is they're exploring it. Everybody says, you know, can this AECOM report work? I have no idea. I'm not an expert in architecture. I'm not an expert in arena building. I have no expertise in that whatsoever. I'm busy trying to build my home right now. That's about my extent of architectural and remodeling knowledge. But one of the biggest architectural groups in the United States, companies, AECOM, says that, yes, it can be done. Two groups that are among the largest arena builders in the world, one of them AEG, which already owns Key Arena, and the other one, which is kind of formed out of the MSG group, Madison Square Garden group, but it's called the Oakview group now, They both say they've looked at the AECOM report and they think it can be done, and it can be done in a way that the new arena is going to be unrecognizable. It's going to be ultra-modern, this, that, and the other. So I'm not in a position to argue with them. There might be sports fans out there that know more about arena building and architecture than I do, or than these guys do at AEG, MSG, and AECOM. Maybe there are sports fans out there or sports reporters or radio talk show hosts who know more than these guys do about the business. I don't. So my attitude is, let them prove it. Let them go out and show that they can do it. And they've got now, they're going to have a couple of months to go out and come up with plans and show the city that they can get it done, and that they can get it done to the specifications that the city wants and the specifications that are going to trump an all-private arena in SoTA. And if they can do that, then, you know, more power to them. Let them do it. If they can't do that, then the city has a ready-made proposal being tailored, reworked by Chris Hansen, and they're going to have that as an option to go to. So I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It would be different if there was an NBA team sitting here right now that we're missing out on, but there isn't any. And there might be later this summer. There might be in a year from now, 2 years from now. Right now, there are none. So we're not losing anything by waiting. Where we are going to lose is if we wait another 2 or 3 years to make a decision, and then a decision isn't made. I mean, so as far as I know, they're going to make a decision in June on this thing, and that should be ready in plenty of time if the NBA decides to have an expansion process. So that's where we are right now. It's going to be, it's put up or shut up time. You know, maybe they can renovate Key Arena, and maybe they can't. We're going to find out right now, but you have to find out. You can't. What they were doing before was closing the process off and not allowing anybody to come in and see, hey, you know what, the situation's changed in the last 5 or 10 years. Maybe there is a way to get this done. And so we'll have to see. If there is a way to get this done, they will get it done. They'll come in and get it done, and they can prove it. And, you know, the city will have to prove that it's a better deal for the taxpayers than what Chris Hansen is proposing in SoTA. And so I think we're going to know something very soon. In the next half year or so, we should have a definitive answer. Again, Jeff, I'm running out of breath. I talk too much. I don't understand what's going on.
You're awesome, Jeff. Thanks so much for your time, your insight, and sticking around with us tonight. Follow Jeff on Twitter at Jeff Baker Times, Jeff with a G, and check out his new podcast at SeattleTimes.com, Hard Count with Jeff Baker. Jeff, thanks so much.
Hey, guys, anytime.
Hey, and congratulations on the house, and the best of luck to you on getting everything completed the way you want it.
Oh, yeah. No, I'll tell you what. We love living here in Seattle, and we've been wanting to make this definitive investment here for a long time, and I'm glad we did. And so we're going to be here. Much to the chagrin of some of my Twitter haters, I am going to be around for quite a few years to come. So I'm sure we'll be speaking to each other again. But thank you.
Sounds good.
There goes Jeff Baker with the Seattle Times, bringing all kinds of knowledge. Baseball, football, arena. He knows what he's talking about.
Man, you talk about having bullets in the chamber, man. Jeff comes out firing, giving us all kinds of knowledge, man. That's why I love having him on, Sean Wally. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we're going to have guest number two, none other than Ray Roberts, so keep it locked in. You're listening to the best sports talk on the double with the Double S Express.
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is awesome.
What's my image?
What's my image?
What's my image?
At Images Barbershop and Styles, you get the best cut, the best design, and the best styles in the Sacramento area. Plus the affordable price, along with the fun, family-friendly atmosphere, you'll walk away with a look of satisfaction and the feeling of a new you. Do you have your image?
We have ours!
Images Barbershop and Styles, located at 10040 Bruceville Road, Elk Grove, California, Suite 140. For appointments, call 916-271-0218. That's Images Barbershop and Styles.
Welcome back to On the Double with the Double S Express, Sean Wally and Sean Boyd.
Welcome back to On the Double with the Double S Express. Sean Wally with Sean Boyd. And let's go right back out to the holysmokenuts.com phone lines and welcome in big time guest number two tonight. And that is none other than former NFL offensive lineman Ray Roberts. Ray, thanks for your time tonight.
Oh, no problem, man. I'm glad to be on. I'm sorry I missed you last week.
Hey, Ray, thanks for being on. And, of course, we know your schedule being busy working with the Seattle Seahawks radio. And so, man, we appreciate you taking the time out. And speaking of those Seahawks, tough game yesterday down in Tampa Bay. What's your take on how things turned out there?
Well, I think, you know, obviously after the first two drives, the defense kind of locked in and did okay, did their typical thing. But the first two drives really kind of put them in a hole. Offensively, I really think after looking back over some of the film today that Tampa Bay really attacked the offensive line of the Seahawks. I think a lot of times teams try to take away Jimmy Graham or they try to stop Russell Wilson from running, but I think that they really looked at this offensive line and was like, we can win some one-on-one matchups. And so they played some tight coverage behind them. And then just pretty much turned the front seven loose on that Seahawks offensive line, and they kind of beat them up every which way, but you know, every way you can think of.
Now, Ray, of course, you being an offensive lineman selected 10th overall in the 1992 draft by the Seattle Seahawks, of course, Tom Cable, he is, you know, top-notch when it comes to developing an offensive line. But what say you as far as this offensive line is concerned? We know that there are some makeshifts from defense to offense, but let's put our offensive coordinator, our offensive line cap on for a second. What would you do, or how would you coach this line to be a little more efficient?
Well, I think, first of all, they have to give them a chance to establish the run. When the game started out 14-0, they never really got a chance to do that because then they had to start throwing the ball, and then you get a bunch of sacks, and now you're behind the chains. It's second and 15, or third and 11. It's kind of hard to kind of run the ball in those situations. To me, this issue started for the Seahawks back in the spring when they just decided to go really young and inexperienced. They brought in one veteran, Jury, I think it was Evans from the Saints, and then released him at the last cut. And so then you set yourself up. I mean, it's really hard to establish a dominating offensive line when you're working with a lot of projects. You have a basketball player, you have guys that weren't doing that great on teams that they were on before, and now you're trying to resurrect their careers here. You have the center that has played right tackle, left guard, right guard, and now this year he's playing center. So, and then on Saturday they started three rookies. So it's really hard to establish an offensive line when you do it. I don't care who you are. I mean, you could be Tom Cable or the first guy whoever decided to have an offensive line. It's still going to be hard to establish an offensive line that way.
Ray, how frustrating is it for you as a former offensive lineman to see teams like the Seahawks that choose not to invest money in well-known, great players, whether it be veterans or high draft picks, even though Ifedi was a first-rounder, but he's having his growing pains, but that the team chooses to take that money and go elsewhere?
Yeah, and it's really hard to quite understand it because they will tell you that they're not trying to save money on the offensive line and that they're trying to find guys that haven't been taught bad habits and having to reteach those. And I'm saying, well, you're having to coach just as hard to take a basketball player and make him a starting left tackle in the NFL versus taking a left tackle from college who may need some tweaks here and there. I mean, to me, like the coaching is going to be all the same. So why don't take a player that has some experience actually playing the position? So I don't understand sometimes their philosophy as it relates to the offensive line. I do know that they put too much credibility to Tom Cable and his ability to coach. I mean, since the last few years, the offensive line hasn't been anything. I mean, they haven't really established anything. And so these projects and taking other guys' leftovers and moving guys from left to right and right to left, guard to center, center to tackle, tackle to guard, like those things aren't working. And you have arguably the best quarterback in the league behind them. So there's something that needs to be reconciled about that doesn't make sense to me.
How about yourself, Ray? Are you ready to suit up?
Yeah.
if it was the third and or fourth and one on the 1 yard line in the Super Bowl and Marshawn Lynch was behind me, then yeah, suit me up for one play. I promise you, if he runs behind me, we're going to get that 1 yard.
Now, Ray, you probably heard this morning on 710 ESPN Seattle that head coach Pete Carroll said he's not concerned long term as long as things go correctly and better on Sunday against Carolina. How does Seattle right that ship moving forward?
Well, you know, the thing that the Seahawks do really, really well from top to bottom is they just don't panic. They go back and they are really truthful and honest about what happened, and then that way they're able to get past it. I don't think you can expect to see the offensive line play like this for the rest of the season, but I don't think that you're going to get them playing like the two previous games the rest of the season either. I really think it's going to be purely a matchup situation. When they have favorable matchups, the offensive line will look fine. The offense will look good. When they don't have favorable matchups, then they're going to have to grind it out and just win ugly. And I've said that since week one, and I still believe it to this point. Yesterday, they just were not able to grind it out and get a win because they just could not get anything going. So I don't expect that to happen anymore for the rest of the season, that the offense will look so bad. But there are going to be some fundamental things that they're going to have to do on the offensive line to help out the tackles, to establish a run game to kind of help their play-action passes so they can get the ball down the field. I don't think they're going to be able to take five-man protection and a five- or seven-step drop with the quarterback and throw the ball down the field.
Yeah, it definitely has to get better for the Seattle Seahawks offensive line. Ray Roberts joining us here on the Double. Now, Ray, you have some great things that are going on in the Seattle area. One of them is Rainier Scholars. Let our listeners know what Rainier Scholars is about.
Rainier Scholars is a program for low-income kids of color who are first-generation college candidates, and it's a very intense academic and college enrichment program. We recruit kids in fourth and fifth grade. We put them through 14 months of intense academic rigorous work, and then we place them into independent or private schools in the area, and then we prepare them to graduate from college. We support them individually and as families all the way through the graduation. So we've had 15 cohorts of about 65 kids come through. We've had four cohorts graduate from college. We graduate our kids at about a 92% rate, which is about 30% or higher than the national average. We've had kids graduate from every Ivy League school, from all the top tier colleges in the country, and then now we have kids that have graduated and are in the workforce, working at places like Microsoft and Amazon and Google and different places around the country.
Wow, that sounds like a spectacular group and a spectacular organization. I believe that's in the inner cities in Seattle. Now, what made you pick that field to endeavor as far as helping out in the community?
I was introduced to the group about 8 years ago. I went and spoke with a family who was going to take their son out of the program to go play sports during the summer. And after I understood what the program was and spoke with them, they ended up staying into the program. The kid is in his third year of college. And so about a year ago, just looking for something to do. I have a master's in education, and I wanted to do something that was related to education. So I called up Rainier Scholars to see if there was some way I could help. And so now I'm the recruitment and retention specialist for the program, especially as it relates to our African-American community.
Ray, what are some things that you try to tell these kids and to enable them to understand that they can make it not only in school but in life?
Yeah, well, the thing that we're interested in that we try to get the kids to invest in is how academics, utilizing academics as a tool to overcome barriers. And if you can do that, the academics and, you know, graduate from college really opens the doors for a lot of other things. And then you get to acquire access. So depending on the school you graduate from, the people you meet, you get access to their network. You get access to what it is that they're doing and how they're doing it. And then you're able to carve out a life that way that is meaningful, purposeful, financially stable, and then you're able to come back and change your neighborhood, your communities, your families in a way that that probably without the access and opportunity, you probably wouldn't be able to do it.
Now, Ray, for yourself in particular, what were the biggest changes and challenges you had going from college at Virginia to the NFL in Seattle?
You know, I would have to say, like, just the speed of the game and then the respect for every single player that you line up against. In college, you know, I played against Marco Coleman, who was also a first-round draft pick from Georgia Tech. You know, I played against a couple guys from Kansas, Dana Stubblefield and one other cat that were NFL players. But on a week-to-week basis, you weren't necessarily playing against a guy that was going to challenge you for 60 or 70 plays. But when you get into the NFL, every single guy, whether they're all pro or you've never heard of them before, they have opportunity and a skill set to really embarrass you. And so if you are not ready to come and play every single game, every single minute, there's an opportunity for you to get embarrassed. And then possibly because of that embarrassment, you could lose your job. So you have to really come prepared to play, bring your lunch pail every single game. There are no games to take off. And you have to have a healthy respect for every single guy that you line up across.
Wow, that sounds like some true grit as far as finding out some of the cream of the crop in football players. Right now, has anything changed since the time that you played to now as far as the development of offensive linemen and their prowess?
Yeah, you know, the thing that has really changed is the way people train and then how long they train. Like, there used to be a time when the season ended in December, January, and you may not have done one single other thing until March or April. And nowadays, guys take a couple weeks off and they're right back at it. And then The training that they're doing that is more position and movement specific versus everyone doing the same workout all the time has allowed guys to develop, has allowed their bodies to mature differently and allowed their strength to be better in different places and different positions. So just the way they train, the position-specific ways that they work out, and then guys are just gigantic. Like, I thought that I was big when I was big. I was 6'5 and a half, 6'6", about 302 pounds. And right now, that's like an undersized defensive end weight and height. And so it's just like these dudes are gigantic. When I stand on the sideline of the Seahawks and their whole offensive line is like 6'7 and 6'8", and it's just like, holy cow, like, where did these dudes come from? And I would never have imagined that I would ever have those words come out of my mouth because I'm just so much bigger than most people I know. But these dudes are gigantic, man. And then obviously the money is unreal. And I'm happy for them. Wish I was born just a little bit later, but the money is unreal, which is good in a way that it can allow guys to retire without having to put, you know, tons and tons of years and plays on their body if they don't really feel like they need to. So that's a good thing. I think some of the support around the league for guys post-career is a lot better than it was. It could be a lot better, but it's a lot better than where it was. So there's a lot of positives, I think, for the NFL and for what players are doing and how they're doing. So I really enjoy watching it.
Hey, Ray, you left out the fact that, you know, you said 6'7", 320 pounds, but you left out the fact that these guys can also run the 40 and 4.7, which is, tremendous this day and age that you have such quick linemen on both sides of the football.
Yeah, the athleticism is just off the charts. Like, from the top of the roster to the bottom of the roster, like, It is just really. I mean, I have to take out the kickers and the punters. I can't put them in that group. But the rest of them are just out of this world. And when you see how hard they work, you see how they're trained, you see how they take care of their bodies and things like that. It's pretty spectacular.
Hey, now, Ray, real quick, I know, of course, you had a great career with the Seattle Seahawks, and you ended it with the Detroit Lions. Both teams doing decent down the stretch here. I'm going to put you on the spot. First round of the playoffs, Seattle Seahawks, Detroit Lions. Who you got?
Oh, I'm going with the Seahawks all the way, man. I'm Seahawks through and through. They were the team that gave me an opportunity. That, you know, they drafted me number 10 overall. You know, I do a lot in this community. Even when I lived in Detroit, I would – do my off seasons here in Seattle. I love the city. I love the fans. I love the organization. I do a lot of public appearances and things for the Seahawks. And then my kids are just diehard Seahawks fans. Now, there may be about, I give them 10 to 15% of me that keeps my eye on the Detroit Lions and want them to be successful because their fans deserve it. They've gone a long time without a whole lot of success as football fans, and so I think their fans deserve a little success there.
Love the honesty, man. Love it.
Ray, throughout your life and your football career, who have been people that have helped guide you and mentor you along the way?
Well, to be honest with you, man, it goes all the way back to my high school career where, you know, I was an outside linebacker, about 6'5", and about 15-20 pounds, and didn't really know a whole lot about where I was going to go or how I was going to get there. And I had this high school football coach that just really took me under his wing and kind of told me the opportunities I could have to change my life if I could, you know, just kind of put in a little bit of work, you know, perform just a little bit better and have an opportunity to have my college paid for. And so he was a big part. His name is Joe Steadman. He lives in South Carolina. He's a big part of how I kind of got it wasn't that my life was off track. It just got it pointed in the right direction. And then when I was in college, I had a defensive line coach named Danny Wilmer, who kind of did the same thing, was like my dad away from home, just kind of took me under his wing, challenged me really hard, expected a lot out of me, set the bar really high. And then when I got into the NFL, Howard Mudd, legendary offensive line coach, is pretty much one of the godfathers of this zone blocking scheme and stuff. Just really took this really athletic dude and gave me discipline in how I practiced, how I prepared, how I, you know, paid attention to the small details. And then as I did that in my athletic life, it started to carry over just into my personal life, just how to just manage my life, how to be very purposeful and intentional about it, and then how to live my life for other people. And I think that's what it's really all about.
Well, Ray, you're doing great things. And my final question for you is, what was it like seeing that signing bonus check after the Seahawks drafted you?
It was pretty I'll put it this way. Like, I had no idea what was going on. I held out of camp for, like, 2 weeks. I came in, was in this – it was almost like being on The Apprentice. There's this huge table. They were on one end, and me and my agent were on the other end. And I signed about 8,000 pieces of paper, and then they slid me this envelope, and I opened it up, and I was just like, "Holy cow!" Like, I had to like look at it 3 or 4 times, and then when I went home, my parents were here in town, and I just told my parents about it, and it was just like they couldn't even comprehend, you know, what was going on. My mom and dad were both janitors. And probably combined, they maybe made $10,000 a year. So it was a spectacular moment. We all just went kind of nuts and crazy, and just really felt blessed that I had the opportunity to do that.
Did you make a copy of that check?
Oh yeah, made a copy of it. I actually put it. You know how you get like those acrylic blocks and things. So it's embedded in one of those. The copy of it is embedded in one of those blocks so that I can have it forever. I don't put it out anywhere, but I just have it.
Awesome. Ray Roberts, thanks so much for your time. Your insight will let you run to Monday Night Football. And if you want to find out what Ray and the staff at Rainier Scholars are up to and how you can help, visit RainierScholars.org. And, of course, you can hear Ray pre- and post-game on the Seahawks Radio Network and follow Ray at Big Ray 72. Ray Roberts, thanks for your time tonight.
I appreciate it, brother. You guys have a good one.
All right. Happy holidays to you, Ray.
You too, buddy.
There goes Big Ray Roberts doing great things off the football field now in and around Seattle, of course, probably at his college home in Virginia a little bit. And, if, you know, it's just great to hear the guys are staying in the community and doing good things.
Exactly, man. And, of course, you know, Rainier Scholars, that sounds like an awesome organization helping inner city kids, you know, find their way and putting them into the right direction, getting them to go to college, get a good education, and, you know, do some awesome things in their career. So, yeah, hats off to Ray Robertson and helping that organization and helping these kids out as well.
Yeah, Sean Ray was super approachable, super gracious, easy to talk to. When I mean, I've seen him in passing and met him previously, but I made it a point during the halftime of the Monday night game. Was working with one David Massey, former Tacoma Thunder owner, and I used David sort of as an in. Hey, David played football at Oregon, you know, broke that ice right there with that. And Ray was great, easy. Yeah, here's my number. I'll be a guest on the show. And locked and loaded.
Yeah, man, that's how we get the great guests here on the Double, man. And, of course, you know, Ray is one of the top-notch people in the community. And we wish him continued success in doing what he does. So, man, we had a busy, busy weekend. Well, I know that you were doing some things with the NFHS Network. Of course, you called a couple of games, one play-by-play, one analyst, or were they both analysts, or how was your weekend there?
Well, man, something, as you know, we both tried to do, I think, what, back in 2013 initially when we found out about the NFHS/PlayOn Sports Network, and you've been working for them for a couple years, and I finally was able to get a shot, and I called a volleyball championship game at the Yakima Sun Dome 2 weeks back, and that was fun. It was me, myself, and I, my producer, and my camera guy, so I was the play-by-play guy and analyst, but there wasn't a lot of downtime, so that was really cool. The high school girls were great at the skill level and playing good volleyball, and, you know, during timeouts or game breaks, we went to commercials, so I didn't have to fill a lot, which was easier on myself. And then this past Saturday, I got a semifinal football matchup held in Moses Lake, a neutral site, sort of neutral. And it was interesting because it was eight-man football. Never seen that before. There's no punting and no field goal or extra point kicks. So that was quite different. And I started the first half as play-by-play, and then other guy and I switched off, and I finished the game as the analyst and tried to do you prep.
Well, yeah, you know, I got a chance to listen to a little bit of it, of course, and, man, you sounded awesome, and, you know, it's good that you're getting that, you know, getting more experience up there and calling the high school games. And just think, man, eventually it's going to be collegiate and then professional. So keep at it, man. Definitely proud of you and doing those awesome things with the NFHS Network.
One step at a time, one step at a time. And hopefully one day we look back and say, remember when. And one team that is looking forward to a potential championship in Seattle is the Seattle Sounders. They get a shot at the MLS Cup. Will be later this week. It was up in the air. Who they will play is between either Montreal or Toronto, that game being played tonight. If Toronto wins, Seattle goes to Toronto for that match. If Montreal wins, that game will be in Seattle.
Yeah, so it's been a long time coming. Of course, the Seattle Sounders having one of the better teams in the MLS, and now here's their chance to get to the Pantheon and getting a championship and bringing one to Seattle. So hats off to the Seattle Sounders, and good luck to them in the coming days.
Well, it's crazy because they've had a strange season. They changed coaches a couple months back, and, you know, things weren't going well for them. And all of a sudden, somehow, they got the ship corrected, and now they're possibly bringing a championship to Seattle. So it'll be interesting to see if they can make it happen later in the week.
No doubt. And, of course, the Seattle fans will be out in full force making the march, across the bridge to the stadium, as they always do, and rowdy and raucous in their finest form. So, again, good luck to the Seattle Sounders on that. Of course, Sean Wally over here, man. Been a busy week as well. Getting a chance to work with the NFHS Network and do a couple of high school games. And Sean Wally getting to indoctrinate two more people in the Boyd family into the NFHS Network, and that is Devon and Deshaun Boyd, my sons, and they're getting their chance to work as producers and camera. And so that has been a lot of fun. And, of course, getting a chance to flex my muscle from high school to college and doing college basketball and then college football this past weekend, along with working in the NFL. That is a full slate of work, man. And, you know, it's the holiday season, and you got to ramp it up, I guess.
That just goes to show you we don't need training camp in Atlanta for sure.
That's right. You know, we get our full-fledged training, on-the-job trainings, and learning the ins and outs of working a network, you know, by having that experience with all the avenues that we have, Sean. And, of course, man, we didn't get a chance to talk about our teams. We've talked with them, with the guests a little bit, but, man, there's a little bit of football over the weekend. And, you know, your Seattle Seahawks went down to Tampa Bay and played the Buccaneers. And I know it didn't turn out the way as planned, but what are your thoughts on the game?
Basically, it's kind of a shoulder shrug. It's the one game on the schedule you look at as the season's been unfolding that the only bearing it really has is proceeding against Dallas. And as Jeff Baker mentioned, the Seahawks lost a game to Dallas in the standings, but they're still number two in the NFC. They're still number one in the NFC West. And Tampa had everything to play for. They're fighting for their playoff lives, and they just last week beat Kansas City in Kansas City. So they're starting to show that they are a decent team that has a shot at a wild card berth in the playoffs. So really, and you hit it also earlier, talking about Seattle went to New England, back to Seattle, all the way to Tampa. So maybe some of that factored in with the travel. I don't know. Pete Carroll blames himself and his coaching staff for not having everybody right, because it wasn't just one or two players that went right. It appeared to be a systematic problem. So he says it's not an issue as long as they get it corrected and don't play like that again this weekend hosting Carolina.
Yeah, you know, for us it's easy as, you know, analysts and co-hosts to be Monday morning quarterbacks and see all the things that could happen and should happen. You know, I mean, these guys are, you know, they're professional players, and Seattle has been there before as far as knowing what to do and how to end the season strong. It was just a little different. You know, there's something different, you know, when I watched that game. You know, for one, you know, Jeff Baker had touched on it, and I believe Ray Roberts touched on it as well. It's just, you know, keeping your quarterback upright. It just seemed like Russell Wilson didn't have the time to actually go through the proper reads and make the, you know, the right calls, you know, down the field. And so that's something that, you know, Seattle's really going to have to take care of here if they want to make, you know, a strong playoff run. I know that they are a few games up in their division, so there's a little margin for error. But, man, they want to make this run deep into the playoffs. And, you know, if they have ambitions of getting to the Super Bowl, then they're going to have to shore up that offensive line. We also know that Earl Thomas was out. Another one of their corners was out. It put a spotlight, I believe, on Richard Sherman, which is one of the things that I talked about last week as far as, you know, Richard having to guard the top receiver. You know, it was kind of a push. You know, he had some good moments, and then Mike Evans kind of, you know, had a couple of good moments as well. I mean, he had 8 receptions, 104 yards, and 2 touchdowns. It wasn't Sherman's brightest moment. So, you know, once the Seahawks secondary gets things shored up, that's going to help them as far as keeping the point totals down. But shoot, the Buccaneers won and they only had 14 points. So Seattle's defense is still doing what they need to do. It's just the offense that needs to get things turned around and get things generated for the postseason.
Which it really is two steps forward, one step back, because the previous 2 weeks at New England, home with the Eagles, Seattle's offense looked like it had fixed the issues, was firing on 4 out of 5 cylinders. Running game still kind of up in the air with all the injuries. And, I mean, ProSize was making things happen, and unfortunately he broke his scapula last week. So now the offense looked like it's, you know, in quicksand again. So we'll see. We'll see if they can get some people healthy and bring people back. And in terms of the NFC, you look at Dallas. I do like what Colin Cowherd had to say today on Speak for Yourself. He said, you don't want to peak too early.
Yeah, that's true. You don't want to peak too early, but at the same time, you want to build enough momentum going into the postseason. You know, I just believe that, you know, when there's an opportunity to win, you win. And so, you know, as far as the peaking is concerned, you know, that's something that you say when things aren't going right. But when you're winning, you want to continue to win. And I think that the Dallas Cowboys have the proper recipe. They've always had a strong offensive line. That's been their calling card for quite some time, going back to the Emmitt Smith days. Now they have a similar back in an Emmitt Smith and Ezekiel Elliott. So they have the pieces in place. They have the Dak Prescotts. And they have a decent receiver core. You know, so I believe that Dallas is for real. I think that, you know, by them getting out to this start, I don't see them slowing down in any way, shape, or form. The only thing that could get in the Dallas Cowboys' way is a wrong decision here or two down the stretch. But right now, if things stayed intact the way they have it, then I believe that the Dallas Cowboys are you know, in stride for making it and going all the way to the Super Bowl.
Seattle taking on the Carolina Panthers Sunday on Sunday Night Football for the whole world to see. The NBC crew coming into town. Carolina staying on the West Coast for 2 weeks as they just played the Raiders to the very end. A tough fought back and forth game with one busted pinky for Raider quarterback Derek Carr. Sean, what was that game like for you? I know you, it was a roller coaster of emotions, I'm sure. And then also, who do the Raiders have next?
Well, you know, the Raiders are, you know, they're doing what they need to do to win. And one of the things that, you know, people are seeing is that the Oakland Raiders have one of the best offenses in the NFL. They can put up numbers with the best of them. The key for the Raiders is to find this balance as far as the defense is concerned. They were on their way. And it was amazing. They jump out to a 24-7 lead, and it just seemed like everything was in place. And then, just as you mentioned, a bad snap. I won't even say it was a bad snap. I would say Derek Carr pulled out of the from under the hood too quick. The ball snaps into his pinky. It fractures in two places. I mean, you could see it dangling as it happened. And the whole air out of the stadium just left. And, you know, Derek goes off the field, then he runs into the locker room, and you could feel the momentum shift. And Carolina actually took advantage of that as blood in the water. Matt McGloin came in for a series, stunk the place up, but in between there, Carolina exploded for two quick touchdowns, and just like that, the game changed. But, you know, here's the great thing about what the Oakland Raiders did. Derek Carr comes back in, and you know, instantly the crowd goes crazy. This guy is for real. If there's any question mark as far as him being an MVP candidate, he threw all that out the window yesterday, because anybody that comes in with a fractured anything, let alone in two places, and this is actually on his throwing arm, and he was throwing strikes like nothing happened. You want a tough guy like that. You want somebody like that leading your team. And Derek Carr did just that. The Raider Nation is in full effect as far as, you know, being excited about this team. You know, I reserve the right, you know, as a fan, I just want to enjoy it right now, Sean, because as we had mentioned, the Oakland Raiders haven't had any success, haven't been to the playoffs since 2002. I mean, you're talking about some 14 years. Just to give you an idea on what was going on back in 2002, cost of living 2002, the average house was $228,000. The average median income, $42,000. A gallon of gas, $161,000. What were some of the cool things that were happening in 2002? You might remember a couple of popular films, Lord of the Rings, The Two Year Towers. The first Spider-Man came out. Men in Black 2 was out in 2002. Some popular music cultures. Man, let's go with, man, you probably remember this. Eminem jumped on the scene. Kylie Minogue. U2 was still kicking in full effect. All those are all the things that had happened back in 2002 since the Raiders had been to the playoffs. So do you think the Raider Nation is excited? Do you think I'm excited? Because this is the first time that I've gotten a chance to be in the Raider Nation while they're winning. Man, there is a huge buzz and excitement going on, not just in Northern California, but everywhere all over the world. Just as Jeff was explaining, the Dallas Cowboys, it's good for NFL, and the Oakland Raiders winning is good for the NFL. And, you know, if these two teams have a collision course to be in the big show, I think that that would be a big, big ticket box office hit for everybody, and the numbers would go through the roof as far as watching the Super Bowl. And man, I'm excited, man. I'm definitely excited about these guys. They've got a long ways to go. They've got a couple of games that are important. We had mentioned the Kansas City Chiefs coming up on the road, and we also mentioned the Denver Broncos, which are two games out. And these last four or five games of the season means everything. So as much as they built themselves up to the 9-2 record, let's see what they can do down the stretch. But I'm pretty confident. I'm pretty confident that these guys are going to win the division, and they're going to look for home field advantage and try to beat out the New England Patriots.
You know what else was going on in 2002?
What was going on?
You were where you belong still in the 253. Mic drop. I'm out.
Man, I'm loving it. My ties in the 253 will always be, but man, I love it down here in Northern California, and it's having a load of fun. You know, my love will always be up there, but shoot, man, I've created some strong ties and a great foundation down here. Family loves it, and you know, man, I'll be up there and always, you know, get a chance to visit. So, good one. Well, man, it's been an awesome show, Sean Wally. We kicked in, got our fix in, and talking Seahawks, Raiders. And, man, we had two awesome guests on the show, man.
That's right. Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times and former Seattle Seahawks first-round draft pick Ray Roberts sharing knowledge on football and what he's doing at Rainier Scholars.
Yeah, man, and Ray doing those awesome things. And Jeff, man, having him on, and he can, as you were saying, man, he has a lot of information and a lot of knowledge. What I really loved is, you know, congratulations, Jeff, on the house and, you know, getting the design and everything that he wants. You know, so, you know, I had to take him away because he was in the zone, Sean. He was in the zone, and I just wanted to pull him away and see how things were going personally. And it sounds like he's having fun all around.
And I hope that most of our guests, and especially these guys tonight, you know, it's not always the same repetitive question over and over and over when they're on whatever show on whatever station. And maybe they'll remember that, hey, those are the guys where I got to talk about my house. I got to talk about Rainier Scholars. And, you know, it wasn't just the typical, why does Seattle's offensive line suck?
yeah, we try to get away from that. You know, sometimes it seems to be commonplace, but yeah, man, we want to make our show unique, and we appreciate every last one of our listeners for joining us here on The Double. Well, it's been a great show. As Sean Wally had mentioned, we had Jeff Baker from the Seattle Times and Ray Roberts, former Seattle Seahawks, and one of the chairmen of Rainier Scholars here on The Double. As we always say here on The Double, you're not in the game unless you take a shot, and when you take that shot, we hope that it's nothing but the bottom of the net. This has been a DSX LLC production for Don Newsom, the engineer, in Paradise, California, Sean Wally, in Celo, Washington, yours truly in the EG Studios in Elk Grove, California. Oh, man. It's been a fun time here on the show. We would like to say go Seahawks, go Raiders, go Huskies, go Cougs, go Warriors. And you've been listening to On the Double with the Double S Express. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to On the Double with the Double S Express. Join us next Monday for some more great sports talk and big-time guests on the Double with the Double S Express.